No, I know you're serious, but...
Lee, we just have to sit in my apartment.
参议员的副总理。
Howard Lawrence for Sacramento Mayor.
Bob Rangel, Sacramento Regional Coalition of Influences.
Steve Waters, First Deputy Ladies.
Leslie Beckman, Sacramento District 4. Angela Lynn, Sears, Sacramento.
Jacob Itello, Mayor Steinberg's office.
Martin Braun, College North.
California, Sanderson. Tiffany Sinnott, Public Defender's Office.
Dorothy Landsberg with George School of Law.
Jim Bennett, Sacramento Self-Help House.
Thank you very much. I'd like to move into the presentation as soon as possible, just with a couple of caveats. We have tried to be very transparent and open. After the last meeting in this room, a group of people thought they needed to get together and talk about things they were concerned about. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that means that the Continuum Care Advisory Board is not hearing well enough. So we really hope our ears are cleaned out and ready. And we really hope that if you have concerns with what you hear, when we're ready to discuss, that you can be clear this is something you're worried about. Express your level of dissent on a 0 to 10 scale. 0, I'm good. 10, I dissent fully. But we just really want this to be an open process. And there may be times when we say, gosh, this is a decision we had to make. But you will see today that a lot of the concerns that we've heard about last time have been absorbed into what you're going to be hearing today.
All right, thank you, Jonathan.
So we did hand out a copy of the presentation to everybody, so you can take a look and follow along if you would. Again, my name is Ben Avey, and I'm the Chief Public Affairs Officer for Sacramento Steps Forward. I'm joined by our interim CEO, Ann Moore, Cindy Kavanaugh from the County of Sacramento, and Emily Halcon from the City of Sacramento. Now, one request is please hold your questions and comments until the end, just in case I happen to answer your question before we get there. But please feel free to write down some notes and we can all discuss as a. Now, I'm going to start at the beginning just so that we all have the same frame of reference as we're moving forward, which is in June of this year, the state legislature passed and governor signed SB 850, which was a housing trailer bill on the state budget that created two programs. The first program is the Homeless Emergency Aid Program. This was a new program that was driven by the Big 11 mayors. That is, the 11 mayors of the biggest cities in California who expressed a desperate need for emergency services in their communities. What resulted from that effort was the HEAP program. The second program is the California Emergency Solutions and Housing Program. Now, while this is a new program, it's actually the implementation of Senate Bill 2 from last year. You remember, Senate Bill 2 was a new document reporting unit that was going to be used for affordable housing. Now, the first year of that funding is directed to homeless services. So, cash is that first year of funding that's directed towards homeless services. Both of the funding pools are one-time block grants, but each uses a unique funding formula and a unique grant application process. So while today we're talking about things in terms of like one program almost, remember it is three distinct programs with three distinct funding formulas and three applications. Now, under the HEAP program, the City of Sacramento, based on formulas, is eligible to apply for $5.6 million. The Sacramento Continuum of Care is eligible to apply for $12.7 million. And under the KESH program, the Continuum of Care is eligible to apply for $1.6 million. Now, one of the threshold criteria for applying for this money is that local jurisdictions do have to declare a shelter crisis. They have to declare it to receive funds for capital expenditures, project-based expenditures, and a few other things. But the big thing when you talk to the state departments, what they'll tell you is the intent of this was to have skin in the game for local jurisdictions. Now, when they wrote the legislation for both HEAP and KESH, especially HEAP, it was very broadly worded. They wanted to give local communities the option and the power to implement what they needed to do to address the homeless crisis in their community. So you can see here some of the examples of what they say that you can do. With one big caveat, this is an emergency program that they want implemented quickly, they want the money on the street quickly, and they want services on the street quickly. Any money that is not expended by June 30th, 2021, with services being rendered, they will take back. And to make sure they're ready to take it back, we have to tell them by January 1st, 2020, if we have obligated up to 50% of the funds. Have no doubt that is them getting ready to take money back. So as we're talking about the HEAP program, we have to think in terms of spending. Now, adding to this, we also have the second round of HEAP funding that will be released in February, which is another indicator of we need to get programs moving quickly if we want to meet the intent of the legislation. Now, CASH is similarly broad. It's very broad in the language on what you can do. They want to give communities the power to change systems, implement programs, do a lot of different things. But the big caveat on CASH is that it requires system change. Within the CASH legislation, it does things like, if you don't have a coordinated entry that's meeting the needs of the community, you're required to spend money on it. If you have an HMIS system that isn't going to be able to do all the reporting for all the programs that you're representing, you have to spend money on it. It talks about money for funding. It talks for a lot of the system level work that the state wants you to do. Now, my rough interpretation of this is that the state is looking at doing more state-specific funding in the future, and they want to make sure that local communities have effective systems in place. And if they don't, they're forcing you to use money within CASH to do it. So that's a big caveat of CASH. Now, there's a lot of talk about capital investments. Because it makes sense, right? We're in a housing crisis, we're in a shelter crisis, let's build this. There's a lot of money to build it. And a lot of money that doesn't necessarily have the very tight timelines that make it very difficult. And so we need to keep in mind that when we're looking at keeping cash, that while it may allow it, that may not be the best solution for Sacramento and the timeline that we have if we truly want to make this an emergency program that's going to get people off the streets. It's magic. Now, the purpose of today's meeting, it is a COC workshop. There are no votes today. Today is for us to give the second iteration of our proposal. We have one input session. This is another one, so that when the COC comes back to their regular meeting on September 12th, we're ready to make some decisions. Following that, we'll talk a little bit more about this. We're going to go to the City of Sacramento, the County Board of Supervisors, and potentially other cities to talk about the proposal. So today is a workshop for us to learn more about the proposal and to give feedback. Another foundation of what we have to look at and remember is, we're looking at this as one program, three different approvals, and multiple partners. While the money is allocated to the COC, we have to partner with the city and the county to do things like the declaration, and to do things like implementing the programs. And so while it technically is a COC program, it is not. It is a three-way partnership between the City of Sacramento, the County Board of Supervisors, and the continuum of care. And potentially other cities. Our goal is to bring all of the cities into this program so that we can all be equal partners. I think this kind of came up at the last meeting, and I just want to publicly acknowledge it's a messy process. The state and their intent was that they wanted collaboration. They wanted COCs working with jurisdictions. They wanted jurisdictions working with each other. In a lot of communities, that doesn't happen regularly. And they wanted to force it. And they are. And it's working. We're all coming together. We're all working together. We're trying to have a very strong collaborative process. But that's not always easy. Sometimes it's a little bit messy. We're just going to acknowledge it, but we are trying to move forward in that collaborative. We also want to acknowledge that we cannot be all things for all people. $19 million sounds like a lot, and we can do a lot of good work with $19 million. But if we start piecemealing it out to 37 different programs, we dilute our impact that we're going to have along the way. And so we need to keep in mind we can't be all things to all people. We need to focus on the programs that we think can have the biggest impact and really make a big difference with this money, knowing that it's one for all.
the input process. You can see on here in blue, we're at the September 6th COC workshop. I've outlined some of the other meetings that we've had. This doesn't include the dozens of meetings that we've had with a lot of the people in this room. I mean, for example, we have the youth input session that we held, but we've had many conversations with Susie. We've met with Bob individually. We've met with Steve individually. We've talked to a lot of people to get their input along the way. We do want to have a collaborative input process. It is not a check the box exercise. And we've received a lot of feedback. This isn't every word that everybody has sent, but these are the basic themes that came through in the feedback. And in this proposal, we've implemented a lot of that feedback. We hear you. We want to do what you want to do. This is a collaborative process, and this is how we get there. We also heard a lot about what populations people want to serve. And we've done that too. I think the proposal that we're bringing forward is serving a lot of the populations that people have talked about, whether it be seniors, hey, single women without children, and most of the population. And I just want to say thank you for that input process. I really do mean it. It has helped us. I think sometimes it's difficult, but it has made the process better and the proposal will be. So one thing we didn't really talk about last time, and this has been part of our thinking and what we're doing, is really what are we solving for? I think we all kind of have in our head what we're solving for, but it's not a question that you might think is as easy as you expect. So for example, some people may look at the unsheltered count from last year. 2,052 people on any given night are sleeping on the streets of Sacramento. Is that the problem we're solving for? Can we build 2,000 shelter beds, problem solved? Seems simple enough, but it's not. Because in reality, last year in 2017, we had 7,000 people identified to homeless service programs that they were either newly homeless or they were returning to homeless services. That's the info. Happily, we were able to house, newly house, half of those people. 4,000 newly housed people last year. That's great. But that's not how many people were actually identifying as homeless. There's a gap. And that is the gap that we have to address as a community if we're going to hit the functional zero, if we're going to end homelessness. We can't look at a static number and say we need to solve for this. We need to look at the systems approach where we can build a system that's going to solve for the person who's going to be newly homeless tomorrow, as well as the person that's on the street today. Which brings us to version two of our concept. The program focus that we're bringing forward is to expand shelter capacity, create a flexible housing pool, expand and align case management, eliminate and or mitigate legal barriers to housing, and improve long-term success through system change. Expanding shelter, we're really looking at expanding shelter every way possible. We want to expand, we want to extend and expand the city's triage shelter. We want to site new city triage shelters. We want to expand beds between existing shelters. We want to open additional county-operated scattered site shelters. And then we also want to work with youth providers on figuring out how we can expand their emergency support programs. I don't know the technical word that I need to use for that, Susie, but she knows what I'm talking about. We also, this is actually probably the second biggest part of our project, which is a flexible housing pool. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the flexible housing pool, but basically, it's a big pot of money that we can use to provide limited-term flexible rent subsidies, one-time support, moving assistance, rental subsidies, crisis fund, owner support. If you think about it in terms of, I know when we talk to a lot of providers, they say, if I just have a little bit of money that I can do something unique with, I can house somebody. If I could just find some rental subsidies for, you know, somebody who may not qualify for HUD programs, house them. It's that flexible pool that you can use to house people successfully. The county is currently using it as a part of their flexible supportive rehousing program, and they're using it for 250 of the frequent users of its behavioral health and jail services, and they have been having great success with it. It's a national best practice. As we look around, flexible housing pools really are an opportunity for us to house a lot of people that we may not necessarily have been able to house in the past, do due to funding restrictions. We're also looking at, within that, having funding for owner and property search and limited term support services, entering the program. And this is where we talk about aligning case management, right? So one of the things that we've learned is people tend to be most successful when they have somebody walking alongside, right? Somebody that they may know the path, they may need to know where they need to go or not. But having somebody walk with them in that process makes them much more successful. And then having somebody there afterwards makes them more successful. And in some cases, we have a lot of case management out there. A lot of our outreach programs, they're doing street case management. Some of our shelters, they're doing case management. And so we're looking at making sure that case management is aligning with things like collective housing care so that we can maximize the success of those programs. And then limited term individualized support services. This kind of follows that the case management philosophy where we know a lot of our shelters, they're just getting by, right? They're just trying to keep the lights on. They're trying to serve the people that they can the best that they can. That they may not have those case management services that we know that they need to get clients flowing through their shelter. They have to flow through the shelter. So we're looking at a pilot program where we're going to provide case management at selected shelters to see if that will help get people flowing through the shelter and thus freeing up more shelter beds, right? Because we can expand shelters, but unless we have people flowing through, we're never going to have the capacity that we need. And frankly, right now in a lot of our shelters, they're stacked. People who are going to stay there for quite a long time. We need to get them moving, we need to get them housed. That's what we do. Now, we're also talking about mitigating legal barriers to housing and employment. I was talking to some of our navigators about this, and I was just, you know, we were brainstorming what are the ideas that could really help them. And they said, a lot of times they'll have a client. And they've lined up a place for them, and they go in, and they've got the money, and they've got everything ready, and then they run a background check, and the person has a felony from a few years prior, and the landlord kicks them. You know, or they have other legal trouble where they're just not able to get housed. So working with the public defender's office, we kind of started to sketch out a proposal where we would do a criminal justice diversion program on the front. Tiffany from the public defender's office is here, you can speak onto it, but the basic concept is when people are going to jail, we can divert them into case management services and try to address the underlying issues that caused them to be there in the first place. If they're housed, they're not going to get a trespass. So if we can address the root cause of that, we can avoid them getting into the criminal justice system. Now, I know some folks have talked about using Prop 47 money for that, or AB 109 money for that, or there's other money that we could use. We're not aware of any Prop 47 money that exists, let alone could be used for this. And AB 109, all of that money goes to probation. So A, you'd have to get the money out of probation, and B, it only applies to felons. So this would give us a much more flexible resource that we think would be far more effective than that. We're also looking at doing an expungement plan. Let's see if we can get things off of people's records so that they can get into houses, they can get employment, they can be more successful. Now, these are some big proposals, and they're big ideas, and I think that they can be very, very successful in the short term, but we also have to look long term. We have to look at system change. We have to figure out how do we make our system optimal. And this money, specifically within cash, it provides us that opportunity. We have a coordinated entry system, but it needs a lot of work. And especially if we're going to line it up with things like the city's pathways program, the county initiative, a lot of the other programs that are out there, if we want to get our system aligned and optimized, we have to put the work in now. And this money provides that. We also want to look at coordinated entry into emergency shelters. We want to figure out a way to make it easy for people to understand how to get into shelters. Right now, we have a different process for every shelter. And really, it's unfair to consumers, and it's unfair to the shelter providers. So we want to create a system that's simpler and easier to access. Again, it may not create beds, but it may create flow, improve the systems, and we can serve more people. Standardized case management. This goes along with the idea that we believe case management is important, both for shelters and in street outreach. But right now, everybody has a different idea of case management. We want to have a standard idea
of what case management is, so that regardless of organization, regardless of program, everybody is operating from the same sheet of music, and that way that we can be more intertwined and interconnected. And of course, we also want to actually evaluate what's going on. A lot of the programs we have, like coordinated entry, HMIS, a lot of the systems level stuff we got, first off, a lot of it is unfunded mandates, and so we're scraping to put it together in the first place. But we don't actually have money to go in and evaluate it and truly see how it's working. This provides us that opportunity to do it. So that when we are building something, we can look back and see if it's actually being effective and it's actually doing what we did. Youth-specific funding, this came up a lot of the last presentations. We've had pretty extensive conversations with some of the youth providers, and we are still working with them. There are minimums that we have to spend on youth. I think, you know, those are minimums. And we're talking to them right now and figuring out what is the best way to serve youth with them. Now, I'm just going to let this slide sit there for a second, because we're about to talk about money and how it all is broken out. But I just want to say, these are preliminary estimates. This program is moving very quickly. We're doing financial modeling. We're talking to providers to see if that modeling works. But right now, we want to show you some numbers because we think you deserve that, but just know they are preliminary. For the flexible housing program, we're looking at investing $9.4 million, which is about 48% of the total funding. For the shelter expansion, we're looking at investing $8.2 million, which is about 42% of the program. Systems change, which is about $1.1 million, and then administration is $1 million, which is the 5% gap. And here, in a little bit of more of a graphic focus, where we truly are prioritizing housing programs and shelter programs, and our ability to increase capacity for shelters by increasing the flow through those shelters. Because we truly do believe that the best way to address the homeless crisis in Sacramento is to house. And that's what we're doing. So, with that, we'll go to questions, but remember there's no votes, this is just a discussion. And then here is an idea of what our next steps are. Oh yeah. So this is the workshop. The COC Advisory Board will be meeting on September 12th. When we come to the Advisory Board at that time, we will ask them to approve the grant application, which is actually very minimal. And designate Sacramento Steps Forward as the administrative entity to submit that grant. Following that, we are looking at going to the Sacramento City Council on September 25th to get their approval of the proposal as our partners, and then going to the County Board of Supervisors on October 6th to get their approval. You will note in there it does say County Board of Supervisors on September 25th. We did push it back to the 16th just because there's a technical timeline.
So can we
present? Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Emily Calvin, City of Sacramento. And I just want to say that the council agenda date is tentatively set for the 25th. We really want to make sure that we're aligned and that we're working collaboratively. So write that in pencil. We endeavor to get there as quickly as possible, and we'll make sure to keep people up to date on the final date.
And here's a few other, just in a second. The end of our presentation. Anybody have comments, questions? You can pass around microphones.
Thank you, Mark.
There's a little light.
Hello, thank you. Mark Ross, Major League in Salvation Army. So I have two questions. It has to do with page 7. So we're looking at expanding the coordinated entry system to include emergency shelters. And that whole paragraph, that bullet, and then the other one was developing sustained case management standards. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I
keep
that slide up.
Yeah, so bullet number 2 and 3, if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, and Emily and Cinder, or Anna, welcome to jump in on this too. It's actually a HUD requirement that we have coordinated entry into emergency shelters that are funded through ESG, right? Yeah, so we intend to do that, but I think the more global idea is that we want to have a coordinated entry so that consumers have an easy and simple way to understand which shelter they're trying to get into or how to get into the shelters, and we want to align that. We also want to look at programs like Pathways and the County Initiative and other local initiatives and programs that are going around so that we don't have multiple programs that aren't aligned. And I think that there are opportunities to expand and adapt our coordinated entry system to make that more consistent. And then developing sustained standardized case management. The idea on this is that we would develop case management standards, and that if you are following those case management standards, then you would have access to the flexible housing. We want to make sure that the providers are all following the same guidelines and doing what they need to do before they access the housing, because we know that is going to make them more successful.
So with that third bullet, will we be providing funding for that training or providing that training to help bring people up to standards?
Yes, we will be doing the training on actually funding case management. I think we're looking at starting with a pilot at selected shelters.
I'm happy to talk about.
Yeah.
I just want to add, I think everything Ben said is correct. And one of the things that we talked about the last time, and it's really important to us, is that we can use existing administrative infrastructure and not sort of recreate the wheel, as Ben said, you know, in 5 or 6 or 10 different programs. So it may be that the case management services are provided by one or two selected providers in partnership with those who are either a shelter or a navigator or this. It might not be within the confines of existing partners, but I think creating those partnership opportunities is one of the critical components. And the county can talk to how they've done it in FSRP. They've done this model where these separate functions are played by different partners depending on your expertise.
And just would add that in maybe CRB implements the flexible supporting and housing program, we are developing, and she is developing in consultation with all of the contracted providers, a case management curriculum that will be multi-week. It will definitely be available to start for the FSRP providers, but will be available more broadly to encompass more shelters and more providers.
I was just going to add that the next federal waiver to the state Medicaid program for the health funds actually lines up with this case management strategy as well, which
I just want to add one last thing on that, which is part of the reason for this also is a realization within the community that following using certain case management strategies like phased engagement, client-centered approaches, we've been able to get a lot of people housed in non-subsidized programs, right? We have been able to help connect them to existing social support networks, with family, friends, jobs, things like that. And so we want to make sure that people participating in these programs, we're trying those options first so that we can keep just a very limited supply of subsidized programs for the people that truly need it. And so we want to make sure everybody's following the same idea of trying to do that first and working with the client before, so it's not just a referral to the flexible housing pool and, you know, we come on.
So, then we had some conversations with the neighborhood, so forth, we're talking about the CDS. Some shelters that aren't part of it, and we're cooperating with each other, helping each other. So what would that criteria be to include those shelters and so forth that are not part of the CES criteria?
I think we would absolutely take voluntary shelters and coordinated entry into emergency shelters. We'd be happy to include you. When it looks at actually funding case management, I think we're looking at funding a few at the beginning as a pilot.
A couple of questions and then a couple of comments. So big picture for the funding slide, I don't think that division of funding is in the spirit of the legislation of declaring a shelter crisis, but be that as it may, What does that get us? 9.4 million, how many people does that street house? And then what is 8.2 million in shelter expansion? What does, how many people does that provide shelter for?
And just real quick, before I hand it down, I would say this absolutely is what we intend with the legislation.
Well, not my opinion, but
okay, go ahead.
So we are working to model some of those. I can give you some preliminary estimates. We've been talking to those who provide these services to try to test some of our assumptions, and we recognize that these assumptions may change. So on the shelter capacity, assuming that the city stands up another, at least one more triage shelter at the same size we're currently at, 200 people, we can get access to an additional 75 beds either through scattered sites or through expanding existing shelters, and that those beds rotate every 90 days, which is our hope and our assumption with access to housing, that would add up to about 1,600 additional stays over the course of the 2 years. And I'm going to say at the very end some caveats to all of these. On the flexible housing program, this is where we have a lot more work to do with those on the ground providing housing and working with landlords. But we believe that over the course of the 2 years, between roughly 500 or 700 households could be rehoused, or there's capacity for that, with the there's funding capacity. What we're not clear about if there is housing capacity and case management capacity, and the ability of clients to share and rent. So we are continuing to refine the modeling, and we'll be working with those of you who do these services to sort of check some of our math and assumptions. I think that's probably, does that answer your question, Mom? And as we get closer, although it's seems like it's tomorrow, as we get closer to an actual application, we will obviously have to refine these, and we'll be working with our partners and with the state to make any adjustments.
So a second question is, on the expansion of emergency shelter, we've made the recommendation, and actually several other organizations have made the same recommendation, that really should hone in on youth, single women, and seniors. Is that going to be the case?
Yeah, and I think yes, all of those. Our goal is that any shelter participating would be as low barrier and accessible to anyone in need. I think that at the city's experience, I don't want to speak for the county, is that we have worked really hard to prioritize folks in our triage shelter bed that probably meet from the descriptions you just described. Obviously, the youth set aside will be exclusively for youth. But I think we all agree that there's a lot of people unsheltered. Everybody needs a shelter bed, and we have to think about vulnerability.
And if I could just add, Bob, the scattered site model really gives a lot of flexibility to target populations that go well together. So you can do a home of 5 persons of youth, or single women, or seniors. So that's one way to really accommodate big specialized needs within the shelter setting. I don't think we mentioned, but we are also contemplating expanding the request to some number of the family beds. So that will be included with the final number as well. And I think you'll see with the rehousing program and the case management, especially as now there's some connectivity with APS, Adult Protective Services, that we're going to be able to flow folks better, if you will, that are engaging in Adult Protective Services, for example, to shelter and rehousing.
Remember what I said, I was going to caveat at the end, is that all of these models and assumptions are, you know, we have a short amount of time to spend the money, and we have a very short amount of time to stand up these programs. While we don't have an expectation that on day one, the day we receive the money, we can have full capacity, we are very cognizant that we need to stand these things up quickly. So another critical component in our trying to align with existing programs like FSRP, like the county scattered site, is we think we can stand those things up quicker, and the ramp up time will be shorter. but all of the numbers that I've been throwing out here haven't yet factored that in because we don't know what that ramp up time is, but we recognize that when we have 2 years to spend a lot of money and a crisis on the streets, we want to spend as little time as possible ramping up. So building off of existing capacity programs will allow us to do that.
Okay, follow up. Yeah, go ahead.
No,
you had a follow up.
I have one more, yes. Okay. And while I think the jail diversion is a good idea, I don't think this is the right time of money for it. I don't see why, you know, the advocates in the county don't, for that program, don't go to the board of supervisors and try to get out, you know, the county board of supervisors to support a jail diversion program. From a homeless civil rights advocacy perspective, it's a little crazy maybe that we would use this money for jail diversion, but on the flip side, the sheriff, the park rangers have handed out about 1,800 anti-camping citations just from January to June. 1,800. So one side is handing out citations that could go to warrant, could lead to jail, and then the other part of the county is diverting people from jail. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I just want to make a comment. Like, with perfect can be the enemy of the good sometimes. So perfect can be the enemy of the good. I hear what you're saying. I think there's some question about whether the other pots of money can actually be used for this. When we know this can be. The other thing is those monies are committed. We have budgets, we have money flowing towards projects. I would prefer more counseling sessions and fewer concealed carry funds. But we've got infrastructure that's being funded that we may not agree with, but that's what's going on. So, just to be clear, I don't even, I'm the one who went on and on about restrooms. I don't see any of them, so.
Yeah, I was disappointed that just immediate dignity needs of people experiencing homelessness, showers, restrooms, et cetera, wasn't considered when it should be.
Right, but I also kind of, I'm gonna, even though Bo Reynolds would say a chap is high, to not see what he wants on here, but, you know, we have to work as a group.
Sure,
and
of course.
We're looking at what the, you know, from a utilitarian perspective, what's the best for the majority of you.
So, speaking of restrooms, the agency head, I think there are a few things here, and maybe I can wait to the party, so maybe have questions or sort of more statements to the office, but we need more toilets, and as we're going to be sponsoring, by the way, the author of the book, No Place to Go, is coming to Sacramento Public Library next month. I hope you'll all attend. That's a real issue, and we're happy to provide clean restrooms, but our library hours are limited. So I would love to see more explanation about a system change and redesign, partly because we have a messaging problem as well, and as the recipient of some of those negative messages, if I hear the words, it's all the fault of Prop, what is it, 847? Everybody blames everything on 47. We need some, I hate to use the word marketing, but we need to get some positive messaging out there about the really good work that you're all doing and that we in our little bit as a library are trying to do with our navigator at Central, who's probably placed more people than any other navigator, right?
Yes.
He's done a tremendous job and now he's leaving. And so there's a messaging problem. I'd like to see us build a common vocabulary and library terms of taxonomy where we're all using the same words, and I would like a little bit of money to do some out-of-the-box things. I wanted to put porta-potties outside Central Library if they're available during the time that the library is closed. What are some options for things like that? The needs that we see every day with the people that we deal with are different from all of the board direct providers, but they need laundry, they need showers, they need toilets. So is there a little bit of money to do some things like that? And also, how are we working with those other jurisdictions that went and got this money? Because I would love to partner with the libraries in those cities, because we're all facing the same issues. We've been facing these issues since I became any different, folks. It's not any different here than what we're in Seattle or Spokane or Baltimore or Portland or Omaha, Nebraska or Sacramento. It's always the same. So if we could use a little bit of money to do some things that are a little out of the box and a little bit of money to tell a really effective story that helps the public understand that they're going to be crazy about it, all of us. Thank you.
So that program provides long-term services in two ways. Intensive case management, whatever it takes, from engagement all the way through housing stability, and as long as the person needs it. And we have providers. It's an open enrollment of providers. You can sign up to be a provider if you need the qualifications to provide those services. And we also have a set of providers, too, to do all the rehousing work. So people, it's people swimming in their lanes, if you will, and really focusing on stabilizing, engaging, working with folks, and rehousing folks, working with owners, working creatively to find situations that folks can stabilize in permanent housing. This program will use that, I call it a programmatic infrastructure, because it's there, and we can actually, as soon as the providers can ramp up, and we will expand the number of providers if we need to, we can start assigning folks to those services. But the services won't go on forever, because this money is time-limited. So it will be time-limited case management and time-limited housing assistance. We know that presents challenges because we expect to serve folks that need, you know, less than 24 months, but also folks that need more than 24 months. But that's the basic structure of the case management. It will be the same type of case management. Perhaps they'll use critical time intervention techniques, knowing that the case management will end at some period.
But at least if we're going to be providing this case management to shelters and apartments, access to those services, is that part of your?
Yes, and so if this case management, we're figuring out the phasing and how much we can do, we'll engage with some shelters. We'll also work with programs that work with people or on the street with people that don't have the ability to do case management, adult protective services. The jail diversion program, we'll be able to assign folks from that program. And some programs already do case management, so Pathways, they did the housing assistance, but they already do care coordination. So we'll be able to flex depending on what, and we're talking about navigation programs generally and shelter programs.
My second question is, is outreach to the other cities, I mean, you know, a little commercial, everyone in this room knows that we're being active in the issue of the occupancy. So how do these other cities have the shelter emergencies? How are we going to put this together to be government structure so that we can help grow citrus heights, you know, but city of Sacramento, Green County of Sacramento, actually all working on the same side.
So in short, we do have a governance structure. That's actually why they're going through COC. So we have the advisory board with Elk Grove, Citrus Heights, Sacramento, Cuyahoga County, and we have been outreaching to them. We've been talking to them, and quite frankly, what it means for some of the smaller cities to declare, we're still trying to figure that out, and the state's trying to still figure that out. We know the county has to declare, we know the city has to declare, but the smaller cities we're figuring out what does that relationship look like, and we are having those active conversations with them so that we can maximize participation.
And I'd like to say something that I think some communities are approaching this as, here's the pot of money, let's divvy it out to the jurisdictions. I mean, that's how some of the materials from the state agency read. We clearly want to do a comprehensive coordinated program and approach with as broad a participation as the state and the shelter crisis declaration allows. So we think we are actually structuring this to be very, very continual wide and coordinated.
Thank you.
And then I think with that, you were hoping for some feedback on your comments. Okay. So,
how do we work with the other big jurisdictions, and is there any money for positive messaging? And of course, as a librarian, I would like to see it pass on.
Sounds good. Toilets, washroom, showers, it came up. There's a few levels to that. First off, is it's a three-way partnership. It's not us just deciding what we want to do. The issues been before the city and the county, both of them are working through it. We had a relatively big breakthrough recently on that with the program that we're running in the River District. When we were looking at this program, we saw housing and getting people to flow through the shelter as the more urgent, immediate opportunity and the best use of this money in that regard. So that's kind of where we landed on that. Working with other cities, I can tell you that's an important thing for Sacramento Steps Forward. We are constantly on the phone with, not necessarily the jurisdictions next door, although we do talk to them, but I would say probably once a week, we're talking to Seattle, or people in Ohio, or people in Massachusetts, talking about best practices, saying, hey, we have this idea, and we heard you guys do it well. And they start telling us what it is, and we do have that collaborative process with a lot of cities. I think it goes on some. But that's how we know that a lot of the stuff that we're looking at, we are doing and looking at doing, truly are national best practices, because we're having those detailed conversations, not just, I saw a headline and, you know, a newspaper in Florida. So we are doing that. And then on the PR thing, trust me, I'm the comms guy. I spend half my time telling people that people are homeless where they're from. Everybody thinks they're from somewhere else, and we have to have that conversation. But that's just one of many misnomers in the community that you have to address at the beginning of the conversation, because you can't talk about solutions until they all believe that shipping them back to Reno isn't an option. So I agree with that. I think we'll take it for consideration, but I do think it is a big thing for sure. So, questions?
We have to change the words.
Hi, Ed.
Yeah.
April with Resources for Independent Living. I just want to make sure that we're not forgetting, you know, the concerns of the disabled population. Research is a little, we do all types of disabilities across the lifespan, and I had a discussion with our Consumer Advisory Committee last week, and I shared the PowerPoint with them, and I heard personal stories from at least five or six of the 15 participants in that meeting who have experienced homelessness recently, and most of them experienced some type of physical disability, and they listed their physical disability as a key reason that kept them on the street and not in a sheltered situation. And some of them did have some feedback about their experience with various shelters in our city, how they were not able to, you know, successfully navigate them in a way that, you know, preserved their dignity and that encouraged them not to And so I want to make sure that, you know, when we're thinking about some of this money, because one of the things that I've always been concerned about, you know, with the, I'll use the word quick money, just with money, with the confusion, is a lot of times the disability community gets left out of that because we need more comprehensive solutions, and our situation can be a little more complicated than just, okay, they need an apartment, I can't just go live in any apartment. So I'm kind of hoping that this funding could be used to make sure that the current infrastructure we have, you know, meets ADA standards, and also that, you know, you could bring in, you know, experts or people who have experience, you know, networking within the disability community to get their advice about how to you know, create an entry system that would turn that way, and making sure that we get less sick people off in the streets that don't need to be there, because disability shouldn't be a reason in and of itself to be
So, I absolutely agree. The first thing I'll say is, if you do have those concerns about any of the shelters, I'm sure that Emily, Cindy, I would all welcome you to share that with us so that we're aware of kind of what's out there in the community, whether we can do anything about it or not, which is what's us doing. I would also note that I think probably more than most other groups, we're very aware of people with disabilities, simply because it is such a large segment of the people who are experiencing homelessness. And so we are aware of it. I think there's a lot of things that we can improve on that. But I do think it is something that we work with more often than we do.
I think just good case management also.
And just from the standardized case management perspective as well, it may never be as good as having a person with lived experience doing advocacy, but case management done right, especially so during the treatment, you have an advocate. You have someone who's looking to take into account the needs of the individual as that person. Every contention program does work to take into account.
I'm Dorothy Lansford from George School of Law. I'd like to talk first conceptually about how we deal with legal barriers, and then I'd like to make a number of small points. Conceptually, to eliminate and mitigate legal barriers needs, in my opinion, based on very extensive proof of concept that we did with well-spaced health, that it needs to be part of the intensive case management. So I don't think it should be a separate block here. When you pick that around to doing your funding, you mean a list of separately, but you did when you talked about it programmatically. I think that to eliminate sub-legal barriers, including increasing the income stream and various other things, it's critical that they be part of the shelter population. I mean, there should be lawyers or various people in now in the city shelter. I know there hasn't been money for it, but if there is money, it should be a very extensive part of the flexible housing program. A little bit of it's being done. There's one of the providers is dealing with disability benefits, but I think it needs to be significantly expanded. So conceptually, I think you should think about that it doesn't belong as part of the case management. And the reason why is it seems to me that if you don't do it contemporaneously, at the time you're doing all these other things, you're not getting full bang for your buck. And secondly, as somebody who's worked with this population for 18 months, a detailed case management is essential in order to deliver the service in an effective way, because it requires multiple touches to get an expungement, to deal with fines and fees, to deal with disability benefits, to deal with child support modification, and to deal with suspended licenses. All of that work does not need to be done by lawyers. We're developing training modules, and you can train case managers to do some or all of that, or you can have lawyers or paralegals do something like that. Everything that we've done demonstrates that we took a $500 child support order and got it reduced to $50, and all of a sudden there was money available to help with some subsidized housing. So I think conceptually, our suggestion should be about that. Secondly, I think that you should consider including reentry population in some way when you expand the shelter. It may be that there's not separate money from probation, 8109 money. But they're already providing some reentry services for people who are leaving the Rio Consumers Correctional Center. And well-spaced health has a couple of reentry specialists there. Some of those people are going to go right out to the street and be homeless, and you can get a pretty good bang for your buck if you figure out how to do it a little bit of what's occurring at RCCC, working with probation that does have dollars. The jail is another total situation. There's very little being done here. As I said last time, 50 people on average are being released to the streets between 10 and 5. A lot of those are homeless. Some of them are people who just spent the day in jail. Some of them have spent a couple of days. Some of them are being released by the courts. on that whole system from those people who are at risk for recidivism and therefore very high expenses and also for bad health outcomes. And so I think that you should consider having some part of expanding the shelter, having people who leave here at least the possibility of being met by a navigator and having some kind of priority for the shelter. Just something to be considered. I think in the flexible housing program, you need an explicit preventive component to prevent people who are currently housed who are at risk of losing their housing for exactly seeing the same things that you talk about in that first bullet. I mean, that talks primarily, I think, about, it's not clear that that's an explicitly preventive component, but if it's not, it should be. And there are a lot of partners in this city and county who are interfacing with those people. So I think it's important to do that. The other thing is that just to make the point clearly, the legal barriers that we're aware of that are making a big difference besides expungements are fines and fees and suspended driver's license, and they all correlate with one another. That's a coordinated challenge with people who have this interaction with the criminal justice system and then automatically get driver's license suspensions. And we've started the project to work both with DMV and with the fines and fees traffic to try to do some strategic changes there. And you're, of course, very likely to support the benefits. That's critical. Right now, I think we're providing it to these 250 people, and you talked about expansion, so that's probably good. I think that's enough comments for me.
Did you
want to
respond? Did you want the response?
No, she's responding for the technical.
Yes and no.
So, let me respond to a couple of statements made about the legal justice system involved in all of this. Part of the suggestions would be funding. My understanding, gave very few suggestions of where this money should go. But one of them was connected to the judicial system. So that is a recommendation the state and the legislators are making, is that part of this money should go towards the judicial system. The homeless diversion program, I agree with you, there needs to be caseworkers involved. And that is why they're building on the flexible rehousing support program, because they already have built in caseworkers. On top of that, our office, separate and apart from this, was given some social workers. We're hoping that we can use the social workers to help with the case managers for the flexible rehousing support program so that we can help an individual that is getting loitering tickets or vandalism tickets, and instead of just guilty or not guilty or spend $10,000 a day on a jury trial, or investing on a person or making a difference, we are hoping to stop that cycle and addressing some issues. And in regards to the expungement process, part of the ability to expunge someone's record is that they can't owe any restitution. Part of that is fines and fees. So we will be addressing that issue through an expungement. We will have to address the fines and fees. And we will work with the courts, the district attorneys, McGeorge, whoever we need to see what we can to collaborate and make something work so that people can get their records expunged, so that people have a better chance of getting employment and housing.
I want to say one thing real quick on the prevention, if we were not explicit, I don't think, which is what we're thinking at this point is that we want to offer, that we want to be progressive engagement with these, you know, hundreds of people that we're helping, which might mean we're not giving enough assistance. So we want to be available if something happens down the line to those folks. That's what we're thinking now. It narrows it. It's not anyone having an issue with payment or eviction. It is a very large population that this would be funding can be. But we do want to try something different. And when we help folks, they're on their own, and something pops up, being able to give them some limited assistance to prevent. We don't want to be suffering.
I have a question. So it looks like the funding is basically in the kind of center, if I have it right, if you want the city, right? my question from there is, how does it, how will agencies work with that mechanism to get the funds out? Is it an RFP, or is it going to be, I'm just curious how does the money flow from that point forward?
Yeah, and that's fair, Virginia. I think that, so there's three pots of money. One is directly coming from the state of California to the city of Sacramento, 5.6. The other two pots are coming directly from the state to the continuum of care. At this point, the $5.6 million from the city, we envision primarily helping to support most of the sheltering activities. I do envision that the city will contract out. We are not an operator of a shelter. And I don't envision us becoming that. So we would contract, in the city's case, we would do a public bid process, seek an operator partner, and contract with that partner. And I'll let Cindy talk more about the county, but one of the great benefits of having the county already standing up a program like Flexible Supportive Rehousing Program gives us that administrative infrastructure. So the intent is that the vast majority of the flexible housing program activities will be administered at the county level, but again, through contract with providers, and maybe Cindy can talk, or Megan can talk about the contracting process at the county. And then the system change components will likely stay at Sacramento Slips Board because they are the holder of our system. They administer our HMIS system, they administer our coordinated entry system, and some of it might be their staff, some of it might be consultants, some of it might be all of you guys helping us. So,
Emily knows that for us. That was actually one of the questions in one of the workshops, was if you're the administrative entity, how do you RFP yourself? And they said if it's inherent capability like coordinated entry or things like that, be administrative.
So the Flexible Supportive Housing Program has been a request for qualifications and it's open, which means we're going to use the existing providers, but we can expand those. And no one knows going from the beginning to the end of that. But the basic idea is we can get started, we can expand capacity within those providers. So for example, just to make names, WinView is an intensive case management provider. We can expand with additional money a case manager, which serves typically 1 to 20 people, and we would just add on, or we would add on new providers. I think maybe probably may want to comment on how you do that, or we can talk to you afterwards, but it's an ongoing rolling process, which is what we intend to use for both the type of case management and the property related.
And I just had a quick point of clarification to Dorothy's point regarding the Disability Benefits Advocacy Program. We contract directly with Next Human for those services. We set contracts with folks overall for county services. So it's not just the 250 people to enroll in the Flexible Supportive Rehousing Program. It's approximately 4,700 individuals that we have active on general assistance. So the pool, potential pool for persons who can receive disability benefits advocacy services is much greater than just the 250 enrolled in the Flexible Supportive Rehousing Program.
So I have a question that is probably addressed in all of the things that you've actually crafted in this application. And I think this would be useful to everyone in here. What is the level of specificity that the application is going to achieve by next Wednesday or Tuesday or whenever it's in there? And assuming that it's successful in acquiring the maximum amount of money from the state, what kind of flexibility will there be to tweak things that are in the application and maybe even add or subtract, you know, particular details over time?
So the application is incredibly simple. It's basically a series of drop-down menus where you add a little bit of detail on it. The cash application is a little bit more detailed. But I think our intent is, even though it doesn't have much in it, we want to make sure that all of the stakeholders have a good idea of where we're going so that we can all be honest about where we're going and we could go there together. So that's the reason that we're doing all of this. We're going far and beyond what the application technically requires. What we've heard from the state is that we will have
flexibility within the pots and programs that we kind of put on there. I think there will be a certain aspect of keeping, you know, staying honest. And then there are opportunities if we're implementing a program and we find that maybe it's not working and we need to change it, there will be a change process. We just have to recognize that the state will be the ultimate arbitrator.
That is exactly correct, and we had this conversation with state yesterday. The other thing that came up is that in addition to us building this ship while we're sailing it, the state is building this ship while they're sailing it. So for example, we are going to be held accountable in our contract with the cities and SSS to performance-based measurements from the state that they have not yet developed. So this is typical, and we will roll with the punches, but that's another really important reason to be flexible, because we think we know what is good for our, we think we know what's good for our community, but we don't know that the state agrees. So that flexibility is also built in, because if they come out and say, well, what we care about is this measurement and our program is completely disjointed,
it
will happen.
If I could add that as we've implemented the county initiatives,
And we are doing very close collaboration on our typical contracts. So we are partners with the providers, which means we are talking on a quiet level basis about Joe and Mary and Harry on what's happening, what they need, what barriers, how we can assist. We are committing to, that is the city and SSF and the county and any provider, we are intending to do learning community, which means, we think it's two-tiered. We think it's a client-level collaboration, based conferencing, if you will, but we also want to do a system-level, manager-level, how's it going, what are we seeing, what do we need to change? If we don't change as we go, we know that's a mistake. So we are wanting to, you know, use data to understand how we're doing, but also the real life experience. And that's when we think we might say, you know, it's not enough shelter, it's too much rehousing work. You know, we can adjust things as we implement.
So I appreciate that the revision really does in many ways reflect feedback that you've heard. So I appreciate that. I have a couple of sort of just technical questions. Is the city and the COC application one application, or are you doing them separately? And this proposal though includes both funds. So is it the city's application is going to basically be for the shelter expansion?
Sorry. So they are required to be separate applications. The city will make it directly. The reason we present it like this is because we intend that the city shelter to be a part of the larger camp program. So just like we want our existing shelters and any new shelters by the COC heap to apply common case management, lower barriers to access and all that, we want to do the same thing in ours. And also I think it's just confusing because the reality is we're one community and our homeless population doesn't think about the geographic boundaries. So, but yes, of that 8.2 million in shelter expansion, 5.6 is the city.
And then the money that you, or the program to mitigate legal barriers doesn't have a dollar amount. So what pot of money is that coming?
I'm not mistaken, it's the Flexible Housing Board. It's part of the case management funding that we'll put in the Flexible Housing Board.
If you have a sense of how much that would be.
It's really cheap. Yeah, I think, didn't we talk about 200,000 for a couple of, what did you call them? Mm-hmm.
Right, so, sorry. The expungement claim, what we would suggest and what we talk about numbers would be two legal research assistants for the county. That runs the county about $45,000 per person per year. So about $180,000 to run a clinic that would probably handle 80 cases a month, more, possibly more than that. There's been talk of us actually going into a shelter on certain days to do masses of people at once and to build on the public defender's already established support staff. None of this money, though, let me put it this way. It would just be for the 2-hour rate. The public defender's office will not get any extra compensation for the supervision, the research, the motions, the legal secretaries, all of that. We're just going to take on the staff we already have. And then as far as the jail diversion, that's just connecting them. 50 people a year would be our goal, so 100 over 2 years of the people, and connect them to the already established flexible rehousing support program. Yeah. And the public defender's office is not seeking any money for any attorney to handle those cases. Those cases are already coming through the home courts. This is just access to people from the judicial system to be connected with services.
And we're building out the financial models on the case management outside of that. We got advice yesterday from the state. We're like, oh, okay, that changed that. So we are building it out. We just don't have the specific dollar amount.
Okay, I just I thought the idea of making sure we integrate this into the case management made a lot of sense. And so I think that should be a part of the program to make sure that will ensure that it lasts a much longer time. Two other just things is it still feels like the youth strategy, and maybe it's because you're working on it, but you've got a lot of this fleshed out, and it feels like youth strategy should be integrated in all of this, not sort of a separate pot.
No,
it is.
But it's unclear what that is and how it's, you know, it is a critical component. And so just knowing you can't spend less than a certain amount of money, knowing how we are going to make a really concerted and integrated and, you know, significant effort to address youth seems to be really fundamental for this, and it's really hard to be able to evaluate what's happening there. So
we do want it absolutely integrated. That's our intent. Actually, the way we put it up there was trying to make sure that we highlight it, that the youth were getting it, but we are talking to them, and part of the reason we're not putting a dollar figure out there is we're trying to work with them right now on what it looks like.
Yeah, I guess just for me, making sure that it's very clear they have unique needs, unique challenges, and unique barriers, how each of these components where they fit in are going to be targeted and tailored to their unique circumstances. And then just finally, I would recommend that we have, I do think, given this is one time and given it's really designed for emergency services, I would appreciate seeing more resources devoted to the shelter expansion. I think we need to get people off the streets now, and that's the quickest way to do it. And people have been, you know, really arguing and advocating, and given the information on the homeless death counts, it seems like this is a one-time opportunity to spend money on shelters that we don't have. And so I would really encourage us to adjust that and have higher standards.
Kathy, if you had 10 seconds to do that, what would you do? Where would you go? I just want to get a sense of when you say that.
I would personally take a little from the flexible housing program. I would have the highest priority going to the shelter expansion.
So it's actually faster to bring people through existing shelters and expand capacity that way than decide to do new shelters. It is, if we can actually move people, say, double the rate, which should be easy, we're doubling the capacity.
And I don't think his point is being made very well, because we keep hearing, build more, and you'll have more capacity. Actually, that's a slower approach, because you have to find and site and create, whereas if you use an existing shelter to a much higher capacity, and maybe Imani can speak to that, you can double or quadruple the number of people served. And you can only do that if you're housing. You can't do it by, you know, people now.
So we do a lot of shelters in this region, well, between Oakland and Sacramento and Moreno. We shelter approximately 2,000 people a day. So we've got a little bit of knowledge about shelters. And it seems to me that the sticking point of shelters is not being able to exit. I shouldn't have said it seems to me. That sounds like it's too not strong enough. the reason that we have, part of the reason that we have a flexible housing program, housing subsidies as a priority, is because people live in shelter. That becomes their housing. If we can move people quickly or more quickly from shelter into some type of a permanent housing solution, then we create a lot of capacity in many of our shelters. And I think Salvation Army could possibly speak to this as well. People have lived there in and out for years because there have been no housing subsidies to assist them. So it's really, these pieces go hand in hand, and I am happy to talk to anybody in a lot more detail than that. If you all know where I live, you know where I work, you have my email address, my phone number, I'd be happy to talk to you in a lot more detail than that, so that I don't take up too much time. But these two pieces really are married to each other.
I also want to just add on to that is that the discussion we're having here is specifically about Keshe and Heath, and that's purposeful, and that's what this is supposed to be. And we do, I imagine that of the city's 5.6 million, if we stand up and operate another shelter similar to what we're doing now, that might get us, depending on the capital cost of whatever we end up citing, a year and a half, maybe 2 years of operation. That being said, outside of HEAP, there are additional strategies to raise money. You got, those of you who follow the activities know that we've raised money from hospital systems to sustain the current shelter. Those activities are not stopping because of this. So this is not the only funding source for shelters in our community. And I think, to Cindy's point, siting shelters and standing them up, new shelters, is a critical component that we all need to be working on, but it doesn't happen fast. And so I just don't want anybody to get the expectation that this money here is our community's investment in shelters.
Hi, Martin Moss, Salvation Army. So I have two questions. So with one has to do with case management, and the second one has to do with repentance and housing. That's all that is one of the classical and transitional housing. It's known as one of the possibilities.
That's one of the options the state gets. Our proposal isn't looking at transitional housing.
Okay, so I won't have that one. Okay, so with the case management part, so would the emergency shelters that are added on with existing case managers be able to keep their existing case managers and then have your case management brought up to speed through training, or would case management for existing shelters be supplemented by an outsourced case manager? Or will we be able to, if we're adding on, will we be able to maintain a case manager?
Yeah, we're not looking, I mean, I think that's a question for the funder form, but what we're looking at is using as much as possible existing resources and more of around the training and education on that part, training and educating them so that they become equal with the other folks, but I'll let them on about it.
I think all that's correct, but I want to clear, this cannot supplant, so this cannot take on current costs that your shelter budget is already paying for, so it has to be new services. So I don't think that to them, one who's as critical as like, are they employees of this organization or that organization, but that they are the new service coordinated throughout the continuum.
Yeah. But we do want to provide training and education for the existing folks. So we don't want to say you have to have new people to do it. It's if you have the resources, if you're going to commit the resources to case management, we'll work with you to get you out to a common standard.
Definitely, even if you're not funded, yes.
Exactly, and that's our intent.
So that this helps operations and not new expanded services around the county and be able to work right place where they need to. So you say you have to have your operating from your existing operational funds and then the DC funds that kind of like to work doing. So what is the
I think there's two things that might be being confounded, especially because shelters can play in both roles. The first is that we want shelters who lower barriers, who coordinate amongst it, who coordinate case management, to have access to the flexible housing program. And a component of that program is case management for those people being rehoused. The second thing on here is we want to expand actual shelter capacity, so operational capacity. Those two things obviously need to go together, but they are interdependent, but they are not one and the same. Does that make sense?
So the expansion would be on top of the existing services?
To the extent that there's physical space and a willingness by a shelter partner.
I just want to touch base with everyone. We've got 25 minutes left. I have the attention span of a squirrel. I know there's something really about you. I want to get a general sense. We've been really trying to emphasize what we've been hearing. We discussed it very well, but we took on board a lot of feedback. So I just want to poll the group out here just briefly, starting with the extremes. Anyone here just absolutely opposed to what they're hearing? They don't feel like it's anything whatsoever. On the other extreme, do we have anyone who thinks it's the best in the world for the service delivery in the region? How about that amendment? I want to get a sense. I don't want to walk out of this meeting and hear that stuff was not addressed, that people didn't have a voice. We've got 25 minutes for voices, and I don't want to hear it all.
I agree with Kathy. Beth, and I, not in the spirit of it, of the legislation, is especially when the numbers of homeless people dramatically increase back to the number of people who die on the streets, going up by 75%. So I don't really get a sense of urgency, to be quite frank. I don't get a sense that we already have, don't we already have a flexible housing program?
It only serves 250 people, so
but,
we're talking
but
about...
But has it worked to expand, to do what you said?
So we are reaching 250 people, we are engaging people that are not engaged, and we're rehousing them.
But did it double or triple emergency shelter capacity?
That is a different proposal than doing case management and rehousing associated with the shelter. But where we're doing that, but where we are doing that is with the full service rehousing shelter, which is operated by Sacramento Self-Help Housing, where we said, we're not just going to fund a shelter, we're going to fund $3,000. And on an annual basis, that's $1 million a year associated with that scattered site. And yes, we are moving people on average right now 47 days, which is much shorter than forever. Now, it may not stay, it's early days still, we get that. But we do think, I mean, I guess I would say, if we can do more people more quickly to existing shelters, then would that be the better approach? Or is it just like we want to see new shelters on the ground? And I'm gonna argue that yes, with rehousing, we are moving more people in increasing capacity. Also in the family programs where we are intentionally rehousing folks. And I don't know if you want to add anything on the family shelter, but that was also the intention there.
Well, also,
yeah,
I
want to
add about Patricia. So, and as you all know, the city hastily opened in part of the VOA almost a year ago, the triage shelter, which was not as purposely designed as the county's flexible rehousing and doesn't come with housing subsidy dollars, but does come with the intensive case management. And without housing subsidies, but with the 24/7 case management, with wraparound supportive services from external partners and internal partners, we've rehoused 130 people in 9 months, or even more maybe. I'm looking at Imani. I might have numbers from a few weeks ago. So I do think there is a case to be made that intensive case management alone makes effects. Intensive case management plus housing support services probably makes a more dramatic effect.
Hold on, I wasn't finished. I'm sorry. But does that equate to doubling and tripling existing capacity. I don't see how the makes sense.
We haven't brought it to scale. We're looking to bring it to scale, or closer to scale.
Okay. The other thing is, I didn't hear the answer to my question was pretty general. I didn't hear any intentionality about, except for Nicole's view, I didn't hear any intentionality about trans women and seniors. I don't think it's a good enough answer to say, well, it will just be open to everybody.
I've got a good answer for you then.
Seniors have unique programmatic needs. You know, I don't know too many shelters there that are equipped to deal, and Imani, correct me if I'm wrong, but deal with memory loss and Alzheimer's and all the variety of things that issues that homeless seniors have that the 25-year-old doesn't have. And we're woefully and painfully short on shelters for single women experiencing homelessness, and that should be intentional.
So on the seniors, I don't think that I said it in the presentation. It was on one of the slides. We are specifically partnering with Adult Protective Services to offer intensive case management that they do not currently have, and we're looking at pairing that with the shelter program and the rehousing programs. So literally that is specifically addressing what you're concerned about, because they do see a number of seniors that are on the street, and right now they do not have options. We're giving them options. And then on the scattered site shelter, one of the benefits of scattered site shelter, and I've actually heard John Foley say it, is it's very nice because you can easily and quickly create subpopulation specific houses where it is necessary. And so that is an option that we want to make available to us, and that is specifically one of the reasons we're looking at scattered site shelter.
To focus
on specific demographics that at the time we see a need to.
I'm just going to make one last comment, then legal services waiting. In terms of the sense of urgency, I don't think Eisenhower looked urgent. He invaded Europe and liberated it. So I think if you look at the input process that we've had so far, what we've done in a short while is quite radical for this group of people. And again, we're not going to come up with a perfect document, but I don't want to tag you on everything you've said, but it's hard to hear a lack of sense of urgency when I see so many people working their tails off.
I appreciate the effort. The sense of urgency I was talking about is last year, one homeless person died every 3 days, and that sense of urgency.
Right. We appreciate your voice in saying that, but it's not like anyone is not reacting to what you're saying. You're not the only one who has a concern about that.
Of course.
Luckily, we have you to bring it up repeatedly, because I know that sounded a little patronizing, but you bring it up and we respond. We appreciate it. That's what we're all here for. We're all doing our thing, leaning against each other, and creating a new structure. Okay, sorry, leave us alone.
Okay, Sarah, so thanks to you all, and I'm going to sort of speak to this sort of balance. And so, Imani, I'm hearing that, and I just, the concerns that we've had with our experience with this balance of shelter versus rehousing is public. So, the low vacancy rate and the high rent put sort of a cap in where you can go, so where you can navigate someone to, or where you can leave money with someone to. And so thinking about this balance, I tend towards what Kathy was saying in terms of how we go that balance of shelter expansion versus rehousing. And the second concern that we have based on our experience both historically and presently with rehousing is that what can happen is a lot of money goes to landlords for 3 months or 6 months or 8 months or 9 months, and then they are back in our office again at that point homeless again, and that money is just gone, and it's gone forever, right? And it provides some relief for that very short period of time, but it doesn't do the sort of structural help that we're sort of thinking about and creating as a community. And so when you're thinking about that balance, case management is absolutely integral. That's the difference between
meeting was really sort of was our project for what I was thinking about as well, is when we're thinking about shelter expansion, it doesn't necessarily need to be sort of this thought of we can only do the tents, we can only do the curriculum or expansions. So this might be an opportunity to think about the infrastructure of bathrooms, of showers, of safe ground, of safe parking lots for folks who are one, you know, one parking ticket and tow away from being physically out on the street, right? So, you know, it's just an opportunity to think about it. It's not that one is not important than the other, it's just thinking about, you know, where you're going to balance that money. Right now, it's tipping towards this, and you know, I feel like it's 3 to 6 months on that money, and we've done that. We haven't created the structure that you mentioned about that meeting to really serve the ongoing needs of those of us.
No, and, we definitely recognize that. That's part of our thinking around the case management standards. We're looking at things like case managers need to stay with the client after they get housed for a certain period of time, specifically so they will continue to work with that person on the next phase so that we can sustain it. That's why we're looking at a crisis fund, because people do have crises after they get housed, and how do we address that? And like Cindy said, that's how we do the prevention on the return to homelessness. So we are looking at those things. They are legitimate. I mean, we were back in D.C. last year arguing about fair market rents. That's one of the biggest challenges we have, is fair market rents are so much lower than, you know, market rate. This funding does give us opportunities. While we don't want to line landlords' pockets, it does give us more flexibility to get people into housing where in other programs we could not. So that, I think, is really kind of the great part about this program, is it gives us the ability to be effective, whereas other programs have restrictions that just, I can't tell you the number of times that people have told me that $50 prevented us from housing somebody. This gives us that $50, this gives us that $200, and so I think that it will be more effective, and hopefully, you know, we do think that it's gonna help increase the flow through shelters, which will give us more shelter. So,
we have a voice from SHRA, I think.
I think Megan will speak to that. She is working with the providers who are trying to be as creative as they can without lining pockets unduly to entice landlords to participate.
The verdict not fully, but I think that it's going to be a lot of things like the DOA and a lot of the property and the tenant service providers haven't been assigned clients just yet, so they're just coming on board. But the thing that we've been able to accomplish, and the first program, the first portion of the name applies is flexibility, absolute flexibility. So being a county entity, we have, usually situated to ensure that we're not people who just need to go standard housing. So with our county code enforcement, the city code enforcement, ensuring that the housing is registered, number one, and that it's tabulated. So that we're avoiding having relationships with unsavory property owners or negligent property owners. Which is a lesson learned from our own college housing support program. So it's something that we've gotten smarter about over the years. But what landlords have said is, fine, I'll maintain standards, I'll register, whatever you need to be compliant. However, things like double deposits, being able to hold vacant units, being able to have somebody responsible on site immediately, those are sort of the trade-offs. So those are the things that we've been able to do in the larger ones, because we're in the housing program, we're able to incorporate using this fund, but for more than the 250 population. So FSRP allows us to be things like control vacant units, to do rehabilitation units, to work with code enforcement and city code enforcement on units that need to be brought up to standard. But it's not always like the property owner's negligent. Sometimes these are, you know, long past, we've had 80-year-old rental property and just don't know that it needs to be property manager. So working with Sacramento Civil Housing and Volunteers in America to educate those folks and to do things like master leasing. We guarantee that you have your rent paid on time from the single source, and you don't have to worry about the property manager.
Systems in our community are participating partners in the city's Pathways program, which is an entry point into this. So it might not be directly from the ED, but the ED can refer you to Pathways. Pathways can make a connection. Also, all four of our hospital systems, and I'll let Jonathan say more, are also referring into the interim care program for recuperative care for, I'm not sure if the case you described would be an appropriate case, and that program also is referring into Pathways. So it might not be a direct from the hospital room to the FHP program, but by working with existing partnerships, there will be pathways for those folks. Do you want to say some more ICP?
Yeah, just in a nugget. What I would say is if you are advocating for us with health systems, thank you. The people we serve are extremely vulnerable and their care can be undermined just by their living conditions, again, social determinants of health. There's a link on YouTube if you just type in ICP, Interim Care Program, ICP referral. That's a link for hospital discharge planners to access the interim care program for persons who are homeless who need a care transition. Okay? So that if you're talking to health groups, just tell them to look up ICP referral on YouTube, and that's who their discharge planners can be contacted.
It seems like there's not enough of those. Because it's not working very fully.
There's not always enough. I mean, I think what the whole person care pilot has identified is how to bring more of that. The program's been running for since 2005. It was modeled after a few other programs across the country that said that a community of our size needed 18 beds. And we have 34, and we're going to have 75. Surprise ourselves and finish a few minutes early. Okay. Well, thank you to staff, and thank you very much to all the CRC advisory board members.
No.
Florida.